With us today, we are so happy to have American microbiologist, infectious disease specialist, and editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Eric Rubin, who we might add is a quarantine chef. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rubin. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's really nice to be invited.
So starting our discussion on vaccine distribution and, you know, the COVID-19 virus and how it's affected our lives today, I think a big focus for a lot of people now is these new strains that we are seeing pop up in different places around the world. So my first question for you is, with these three vaccines that we have available to the public, should the public be concerned that these vaccines may be less effective to these new strains?
Well, Jaden, if it's okay, I'm going to take a step back before I get to that question. Why are there new strains? You have to remember that this virus was a bat virus, and somehow, we don't know how, it made the leap into humans. But it was still a bat virus. It's just a lucky virus that was good enough to get into humans and then to spread pretty efficiently in humans. But it was never made for humans. It was never adapted to humans. So what we're seeing here is evolution in action. The virus is becoming a better human virus. Now, what it's had to deal with is a big population of susceptible people, people who were not immune to the virus, and it was a great opportunity for the virus to spread. But what has happened in certain places is that people have developed disease, recovered, and developed an immune response. Now the virus has a harder time because it's harder to infect those people. And now we're seeing some mutations, some evolution that's allowing those viruses, some of those viral variants, to infect people who had previously been infected. And so as we produce new pools of people, the virus has a new barrier, and it is trying at least to evolve to get around that. Now it looks like the vaccines that we have, many of them are still pretty good, and because they induce a probably more substantial immune response to the virus than natural infection does. So at least some of the vaccines we have look like they work pretty well in the laboratory, and there's some evidence for some of them in real people that they're continuing to work. But it's not true for all of them. And some of the vaccines that are being used in the world right now don't appear to protect particularly well against some of the viral variants.
Okay, so one question I have is, I know we're all aware that this vaccine isn't like many other vaccines that has multiple doses. So in a very like Lehman down version, are you able to explain exactly how the vaccine works?
So vaccines work like real disease. The first time you see an infection, you mount an immune response to that. And then the next time you see it, you can mount a better immune response and often fight it off. A vaccine is reproducing that. You get a vaccine, it gives you a shot of what's called antigen, the part of the virus in this case that you can mount an immune response to. And then that immune response, once it's made, it kind of fades away. But if it sees that antigen again, it boosts. So it gets a higher response. So for two of the vaccines that we have in the US, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, we know that a second shot gives you more, an increased immune response. We don't know how important that is, but it does look like in the most recent data from Israel, where there are a lot of people vaccinated, it does look like two shots is better than one, at least for the Pfizer vaccine.
So just a quick follow-up. So is there any like specific reason as to why, like other vaccinations, like your flu shot, why there isn't multiple doses of that? Or is it just because it's such a new strain that as much protection as possible is just beneficial?
You know, I think that there are two reasons why the flu shot's only given once. One is that it works okay if it's given once. It might have worked better if it was given twice, but logistically, you need to get it out at the beginning of flu season. It's really hard to give people two shots. But the other thing is, for people who get vaccine every year or even miss occasional years, you really are getting a boosting effect, because the flu vaccines are similar enough to each other that you still get boosting even though there are some differences. Now, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is a single shot because in the early trials, it looked like that produced a good enough immune response to be pretty protective. There's a trial going on right now to test to see if two shots is better than one, but we won't know the answer to that for a while.
So with that logistic issue that you brought up in mind, is that why we've seen such an issue with vaccination distribution in the United States? Is it because of that, that you know, the double doses that it takes in order to get a proper vaccine?
I think there's no question that it's way harder to give two doses than one. It's not just that you have to use twice as much vaccine, but the logistics are really hard. Getting people to come back for a second dose and keeping track of who that was and making sure you have enough doses for the second time they have to show up, it is a major nightmare. Some places are handling it better than others. Here in Massachusetts, where I am, if you get your first shot, you have an appointment for a second shot right that day. They make that appointment and they ship enough vaccine to cover all those second appointments. I know that in Florida, for example, where you guys are, not so much. A lot of people have had to work hard to try to find their second vaccine. And that's not a very efficient way when you're trying to capture everybody.
So, you know, we've seen that a UK variant has come out, but we've also seen the rise of a South African variant. Should people be worried about maybe another variant somewhere else in the world popping up?
So, I don't want to be alarmist, but yes, I think we don't know what's going to happen. Getting back to what I was telling you before, Jaden, the UK variant is an example of a virus that's getting better adapted to people. But the South African variant looks like it's better adapted to people who have previously been infected, which is the scarier version. So the UK variant transmits more easily. The South African variant probably transmits more easily too, and can overcome some level of immunity. And as we have more immune people, we're gonna put more pressure on the virus to do that more. How do you get out of that? You can vaccinate more people because vaccination seems to be better. If you close down the number of people who the virus could affect, you decrease an amount of virus and you decrease its rate of evolution. So anything you do to decrease the amount of disease, the amount of infection in the world, decreases the chances of a scary variant coming up.
So I'd like to digress a little bit from the science of the vaccine. And I'm sure we're all aware that there's a specific distribution plan about who's able to get it and when. Do you believe that a certain group ought to be prioritized in this entire scheme of things? And if so, which group and why?
I'm going to be a little agnostic about this one, because every group has a very good claim on why they should get it. We here in this country have prioritized the elderly in most states, and that's because they have the highest chance of dying. But if we wanted to limit the amount of transmission, we'd give it to the people who encountered the most people. That would probably be essential workers, right? Because they're the more likely to run into more people. If we wanted to make sure that we had enough hospital space for everyone who got sick, we'd vaccinate healthcare workers. And if we wanted to get kids back in school, we'd vaccinate teachers first. So there's a good argument to be made for all of them. And someone has to make that value judgment in the end, because it's a zero-sum game. If you vaccinate more teachers, you're going to vaccinate fewer elderly people or essential workers. It's not a decision I'd like to make. And we do elect people to make those decisions. And some of them have done a very good job of it, and some not so much.
So with vaccine distribution, we saw that the Biden administration started with, I believe it was a prediction for everyone to be vaccinated by May, and then transitioned to July, and I believe it's now back into May. Do you see that as a possibility where everyone could be vaccinated, or do you believe that we may see a lot of kind of lagging behind that goal?
So I think that the goal, I just to be clear, I think the goal is that there'll be enough vaccine for everyone in May, but then it will take a while to roll that vaccine out to everybody. So I think we're still talking about July if there were enough doses available in May, just because of the logistics. There are a lot of people who don't want to get vaccinated for various reasons. So is it practical to get it to everybody by the summer or during the summer? Maybe. Are they going to all get it? Almost certainly not. And how important is that going to be? I'm not sure. There's no question that more is better. We don't have to be perfect, but we need to be pretty good in order to really use vaccination as our major tool for fighting disease.
So I like to bring up a point of discussion, and I feel like it's something that can be very easily answered, but we should debunk some of the myths about the COVID vaccine or the virus itself. So when we first started this podcast, our very first episode was about the COVID vaccine, the COVID virus, and that was months and months ago at the beginning of quarantine, and a lot has changed since then. So there is these rumors going around that possibly the virus was like manufactured in a lab and some mishap happened, or was it actually a bat that came from a meat market in Wuhan?
So we don't know. We don't know for sure. The sequence data from the virus strongly suggests that it wasn't a man-made virus. Could it have been a virus that was in a lab somewhere that had been isolated from an animal? Yeah, could have been. We'll never know. But it wasn't made by people. There's nothing deliberate about this. For the other viruses that are similar, the other coronaviruses, they were transmitted to people, but they were transmitted to people via an intermediate that we really see. We don't run into bats all that much. The major, the diseases that we get from bats are, in this country, is really only rabies, and that's very, very rare. And in Africa, it's probably Ebola. Ebola probably comes from direct contact with bats, but we don't see bats that much. So the original SARS, the first SARS first version 20 years ago, came from wild animals. It came from something called a civet. And the MERS virus, which is still present, still being transmitted in the Middle East, comes from camels. But both of them were originally bat viruses that got into something else. So we'll never know, I think, what that intermediate animal was, but it probably did come from another animal.
So you had brought up that there doesn't seem to be any evidence supporting the fact that it was man-made. But it just kind of seemed to me, would there be any sort of, like, would there be like a specific kind of evidence that would suggest it being man-made? Like if that were to ever exist, a man-made virus, like what would be the indication of that you had brought up?
So the virus that we see has lots of little changes as compared to any other coronavirus that we've seen. Lots of them. And it's really hard to make a virus with lots of changes. It would be technically extraordinarily difficult. And there's no reason to think that you would come up with this combination of mutations. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. And technically, that's a really hard thing to do. I'm a molecular biologist. And technically, it would be very hard to do that. So it's extraordinarily unlikely. I haven't been to the lab in Wuhan. No one has, no one's investigated. Just seems wrong.
So a lot of people have a lot of skepticism about the vaccine, and for many different and very valid reasons. But a big chunk of skepticism that has come out recently is the claim that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is in some way inferior to the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines already came out. Is there some sort of misconception that you feel should be addressed to the public about this?
I think we don't know the answer to that. I think it's they haven't been compared head to head. Each vaccine had its own trial, and they were done at different times, and there were different variants around, and the amount of disease was different in each case. So it's hard to compare the numbers to each other. It may be that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine isn't quite as good, but it's still good. And we don't know that it is in any way inferior. It does seem to have activity against some of those other variant viruses. So it does the kinds of things we want. It does seem to prevent serious disease, which is really, really important. And right now, there's just not much vaccine around. So if someone offers you a vaccine, I'd say you should just take it, whatever it is. And if it's clear later that it's important that you get another dose or that you get some other vaccine, it won't prevent that. So I just think people should, the best vaccine you can get is the one you can get.
Yeah, I mean, my parents agree. They try to get one as fast as possible. They have their scheduled for this upcoming Friday. So, you know, just 2 days they're going to get there. So they just kind of thought, you know, as soon as they possibly can, that's when they wanted to do it. But I wanted to ask, you know, about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Some of the concerns are that, you know, early reports show that it wasn't necessarily as efficient as the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, that the efficacy rates weren't as high. Do you think that can be attributed to the fact that it's only a single dose? And if it was a double dose, it might be a little bit more efficient in terms of, you know, comparing it to the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine?
So I don't know. The premise of the question is that it's not as good. And I don't know that we know that, but it's certainly possible that a second dose might make it better. The very early phase data suggested that the second dose didn't make so much of a difference for this vaccine, which is why they went ahead and did a one dose trial. But we will know the answer, I think, because that the trial that's going on right now, it depends on how many cases there are, because the case rate has dropped, but I suspect it'll be done within the next month or two. And so we'll have an answer. And all those people who are getting single doses right now, they'd be eligible for another dose if it were better.
So before I go on with my question, I'd like to clarify something in your answer from the last one. You specifically said if someone offers you a vaccine, I say take it. I think that's a little too literal in this sense, because I don't want someone to pull up to me on the street and say I have the vaccine, right?
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. I think a legitimate vaccine is probably best. But you know, we've all been dancing around the question of vaccine hesitancy, about people choosing not to get vaccinated. And people have a lot of different reasons, as you guys have said, for why they aren't getting vaccinated. And I think it's important to listen to any individual and kind of get an idea of what it is that's motivating them. And so you can help them think through what the issues are. But I will say that some of the common issues are it wasn't tested the testing was very quick, short. And that's true. We don't usually have such a short testing time because we don't have an emergency and we don't also have hundreds of thousands of people, so we can test very quickly. So part of the reason it's so quick is because it was really easy to do a quick trial. Whereas for most diseases, we have to wait for years to get enough cases to get a convincing answer. The issues with vaccine safety usually come up very shortly after vaccination. And then the other concern is that it's made people sick, the vaccine. That's kind of true. I mean, you know, a fair number of people, their arm really hurts. Some of them get a fever. A lot of people feel like they're kind of snowed the next day or maybe a day or two. But if you compare that with COVID-19, there's no comparison. No one dies from the vaccine. There are barely any cases that are convincing of any serious problems from the vaccine. And the ones that have been reported are extraordinarily rare. So compare that with the known risk of COVID-19. I don't think there's any comparison.
Yeah, I just think that if I was like walking down the street and someone just came out of an alleyway and just said like, "Hey kid, you want some vaccinations?" I'd be like, "Get away from me! Just leave me alone."
Okay, I'm with you there.
Some needles in his coat. Like I'm out of there. I'm running away.
That reminds me of the movie It, where he's just in the gutter. He's like, "You want your vaccine?"
Yeah,
you'll get vaccinated down here, Johnny.
And it's not going to happen here so much. But you know, in other countries, it's going to happen a lot.
Oh yeah. I'm actually thinking about that a little bit.
Yeah.
But to go to my actual question I had earlier, considering how the vaccine has been distributed, and this question will probably transition us into a little more of like the implications of the topic. So do you think the return to normalcy we've been getting is a little premature? And I'll give an example. So I think a week and a half ago, me, Evan, and Jaden went to our school campus to take the SAT, and the COVID like guidelines there weren't as strict as I'd assume them to be. And I guess it's kind of sensible considering the majority of the people are kids and it's not as detrimental for them. But even then, just the practice itself.
So we have different rules in different places right now. And of course, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It would be different if the case rates were really tremendously different across the country, or if the rate of vaccination were really tremendously different. There are differences and those matter, but a lot of what's driving the push to loosen up restrictions is political. It's not really public health. Very few of these decisions are being made by public health people. Now, don't get me wrong, they shouldn't be. Public health people should be informing the decisions, and these are political decisions. Politicians have to weigh public health considerations against economic considerations and such. But people have taken that to extremes. Not wearing masks is stupid. There's no economic advantage in not wearing a mask. And we have a few states that have dropped their mask mandates.
Texas,
Mississippi, and other states are considering it. And then in other states, mask wearing is not that, it's not so common. In Florida, it is very different up here. I mean, we restaurants are going to be reopening a little bit more, but we have barely anything. I haven't been to a restaurant for over a year.
Really?
Yeah.
I find that surprising. So sorry to cut off a little bit, but every restaurant is open here, and it just goes to show completely difference in like how everything works.
Yeah, I mean, one advantage in Florida, and to be fair, is that the weather's so much nicer. You can sit outside at restaurants, and here we still have snow on the ground. But but the attitudes here are different, and we have a lot of disease, and we still have a lot of disease. We have more than Florida. We have a higher rate than Florida does right now, despite the fact that we have more restrictions. People look at that and say, "Well, that means restrictions don't work." Of course not. It's just common sense. Of course, restrictions work. New Zealand, Taiwan, these countries have completely eliminated disease based on restrictions. They don't have any vaccine, and they've been able to use these tools like masking and public distancing, social distancing and such. So I think that it's not crazy to do some extent of reopening. It's not crazy to allow people to go work their jobs. It's not crazy to have some restaurants and have people be able to see some friends. But you have to think about that in the context of how can we do those activities in the best way possible that try to minimize risk. There are ways to minimize risk. It's not an all or nothing decision. And I think some places are doing that more wisely than others.
So a lot of people in the United States, when we think about vaccine distribution, kind of limit our idea to the United States. But how important is it that we actually distribute vaccines to everyone across the globe? And when do you think that this could actually happen?
Well, this gets back to one of your first questions about viral variants. The thing about infectious diseases is they spread. They do not respect boundaries. And if we don't control disease in countries that border us, like Canada or Mexico, or countries that we don't even like North Korea or Iran, those diseases are going to spread outside their borders and they're going to come to us. So it is in our, aside from the fact that it's the right thing to do, it's in our interest that we be giving vaccine across the world. How much is that going to happen? It probably is going to happen, but it's going to happen slowly. Right now, the large international consortium, COVAX, that is buying vaccines for worldwide distribution, They're in the open market competing with everyone else, particularly Europe right now, which is a little behind the US in having secured enough vaccine for everybody. So it's going to take a while. People seem to be predicting that at the end of the year, sometime in the middle of next year, there'll be enough vaccine for everybody, but it's going to be some time.
So I think the news that everyone is really looking for to hear when it comes to COVID is, when can we get back to normal? So in a scenario where everyone, you know, specifically let's look in the US here, is vaccinated, what do you expect life to look like?
Okay, so first the date. I've decided that the date that everyone thinks is going to be back to normal is the last week in July, because we have tickets to the Olympics in Japan, and I really, really want to go.
But I think amazing.
I think they're just on the verge of not allowing foreigners to go to the Olympics. So I think we're out. Or my wife can go. My wife and my kids can go because they're Japanese and I can't go. But realistically, it's going to be longer than that, because getting back to the question of when will people be vaccinated, if that's going to be the limiting factor, it's going to be a while longer. I think life is going to get back to completely normal, just the way that it was before. But that is going to take time, and it's going to happen in steps. There's not going to be a single one day we say, don't do anything. You know, be very, very careful. If you're at risk, don't go outside your house. To you can do anything you want. But I think we will get there. There are a lot of people who are saying we're going to have to wear masks for the rest of our lives. I doubt it. I mean, this is a solvable problem. We've already shown that we can make vaccines against it really quickly, amazingly, really, a miracle of modern medicine. If we needed to make new vaccines, it would be even easier and faster. So I don't think that is going to be the limiting factor. But I think we've also made it really hard for ourselves by not taking advantage of really strong social measures, masking and social distancing and things like that, by encouraging people to believe that these things don't work or aren't important. We've increased the number of cases a lot, and we've really now have ended up relying on the vaccine to be our miracle. We didn't have to be this way. Many other countries are like us. There are a lot of bad examples out there, but there are countries that haven't done that and have done really well.
So, kind of a trend that's been going on recently is people will be, you know, looking back at things that we used to do, you know, before COVID, you know, some strange practices. Like, I know a lot of people have come to realize that blowing out candles is kind of, you know, the weirdest, grossest thing ever. So do you think there's any kind of like long-term, more, you know, social implications of the COVID, of like the whole coronavirus, any kind of like, more like trends that will continue to, you know, live on even if the virus has pretty much just kind of been eliminated?
Yeah, there's no question in my mind that there will be, people will be much more reluctant to do some of the things that they did before, to hug everybody for a while. I hope it gets back to normal, though. I hope that doesn't continue. Let me turn that around. Evan, since you asked the question, what do you really miss doing that you love to do and you haven't been able to do for a year?
Well, I miss doing a lot of things. Just like personally, I've actually started going back to physical school. Like about half the week I'll spend physical school, and that's really helped me just kind of, you know, getting back in the groove of things when it comes in terms of like my schoolwork. I don't want to get into too many details, but I've been lagging behind a little bit because of the whole quarantine. So doing that has helped me get back into a little bit more of a normalcy. But you know, I've really only got to see my friends in person. Like Armand and Jaden here, I've only probably seen like once or twice in the past like 8 or 10 months. Yeah, in the past year, I really get to see them like barely at all. You know, fortunately, I get to see them, you know, every couple of weeks or so for the podcast. But in person, I've barely got to even talk to them, which is really unfortunate. So, you know, getting to see my friends, like, you know.
Might I add that Evan's also a semi-professional youth polo player, and he hasn't been able to do that as much because of the virus.
That is not even remotely true. not even close. Not even close. I hate horses.
You like horses?
No, I'm kidding. I like horses.
I want to try each one of you out, though. Let me turn the tables. Armand, what is it that you really want to do?
This is going to be a little bit of a tangent, but prior to the virus, I was traveled everywhere for speech and debate tournaments. I'm really big on speech and debate. It's something that I like to go to college for, something that I've avidly competed online almost every weekend, even last weekend and this coming weekend. Everything's been online, and it's been a real bummer, if I'm going to be completely honest.
It's depressing. And you, Jaden? Yeah, I think we're very locked down up here, and I don't, aside from when I'm working in the hospital, I barely leave the house.
Do you miss the most, Dr. Rubin?
That's an easy one for me. Number one, I miss my kids. I don't get to see them very often, and I see them from a distance. Although I think that's going to change since the younger one is now vaccinated. My 88-year-old mother-in-law lives with us. She's vaccinated. My wife is about to get vaccinated. So I think we're going to start getting back together again. And I love that. The older one, we'll probably see him too, because it's once we're all vaccinated. And then the other thing is travel. I travel a lot for work, and I spend a lot of time in Africa and Asia, and some in Europe, and I love to travel. I haven't been on a plane since. So in the months before this struck, I was in Singapore, and then a vacation with my wife in Cambodia, and then I had a meeting in Switzerland, and then I went for a week in Japan in last February. And when I came back from Japan, and when I was there, I made rounds in a hospital and saw one of the patients who had come off the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which was one of the earliest outbreaks. And then when I came back, the hospital required me to quarantine for 2 weeks. And that was the last time I've been anywhere other than driving from the house to the hospital.
Wow. So I think that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Dr. Rubin, for coming and speaking with us. Is there any last words you'd like to say to the audience of the Gradient Podcast?
You know, I want to get back to the question of vaccine hesitancy. If your listeners are unsure, I think you should talk to people you trust. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And if you have an opinion, you can find the same opinion on the internet, guaranteed. But go to people, and I think in particular, your doctors, and ask them what they're doing, and ask them what they're doing for their families. I suspect you'll find out that most of them have chosen to get vaccinated. The people who understand the risks well are choosing the vaccine. So I hope people really get it.
So finally, we want to once again thank Dr. Rubin, for joining us on today's episode of the Gradient Podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on. We hope that, you know, as we talked about, we can get sort of that return to normalcy, you know, as the vaccine distribution starts to come to a head. So with all of that said, you know, once again, we want to thank you very much for joining us. We want to thank our listeners for having the time to, you know, listen to someone like you speak. And, you know, is there anything else you want to say before we go, or?
No, thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.